Islamic State is dramatically changing the dynamics of jihadist organisations in one of our nearest neighbours, Indonesia. And in part, it's happening under the radar. That's according to Greg Feely, who's Senior Fellow in Indonesian Politics at the Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at the ANU. Pro-Islamic State forces include the high-profile former head of Jamaat Ismailia, Abu Bakr Bashir, and prominent jihadist intellectual Amin Abdurrahman. Both Bashir and Abdurrahman are serving sentences for terrorist offences, but have declared their allegiances to Islamic State in a ceremony conducted at Indonesia's highest security prison in central Java. And of course, their influence isn't bound by prison walls. Greg Feely, welcome.
Good morning, Norman.
What is happening?
Well, the Islamic State, or let's just call it ISIS, is having quite a polarising effect on Indonesia's relatively small jihadist community. And one of the things that it's doing is causing realignment among people who have had a long background in dangerous jihadist activity. And that includes, of course, the two men who you've mentioned, Abu Bakr Bashir and Amin Abdurrahman. So Bashir is a particularly interesting case, because after he was released from jail on his second terrorist offence, he left Jemaah Islamiyah, the organisation who he'd helped found, and he established a new organisation, which probably had several thousand members, we don't know exactly, called Jamaat Ansharut Tauhid, or JAT. And when he pledged allegiance to the Islamic State in the middle of 2014, he lost most of the members of JAT because they strongly objected to his change of stance. They objected to what the Islamic State was doing. They didn't feel that it had been properly constituted, and they particularly objected to Abu Bakr Bashir pledging his support to that organisation. So he was left with a rump of an organisation, and that had previously been probably the largest hardline Islamic group in Indonesia. So that's an indication of how ISIS is causing a kind of a shakeout in jihadist communities, and people are choosing to be pro or against it, and that's the polarising effect it has.
How's it played out then in 2015 so far in terms of, you know, has that rump under Bashir or Abdurrahman expanded? Do we know to what extent it's spreading underground? When you imply that it is spreading and it is becoming stronger.
It's very hard to know exactly. All that we can see are small indications of this activity. So someone may be arrested trying to leave Indonesia for Syria, or indeed arrested, as quite frequently happens, on the border of Turkey trying to get into Syria. Or we can look at some of the web-based activity that takes place. And there are a number of websites that are very much pro-ISIS and have become propaganda tools for them. So these sorts of things, of course, we also have announcements from the police. Pardon me. So these sorts of things are like lighting a match in a dark room. You suddenly get a glimpse of what kind of activity is taking place, and then the match goes out, and then we know the activity continues, but we just can't see it. So it's likely that it is continuing. There's some intelligence that's been gathered by researchers that suggests that there are a long queue of Indonesians who would like to go to Syria and Iraq, but haven't found the means to get there yet. Most people need a reference or a recommendation from an established jihadist in Indonesia in order to be able to make the connections that gets them into the Islamic State. And that's one of the things that's holding up the movement of people.
Which suggests there's still a reasonable bottleneck. How many Indonesians do we know have gone to the Middle East to fight?
There are various estimates of this. At the high end, they range from some 500 to 600. But I think the far more reliable estimates are the ones that come from the counterterrorism police. And the most recent figures put the number at 136. I think most observers believe there's probably at least several dozen more than that who are currently in Iraq and Syria. We know that 11 have been killed. Another 11 or so have returned to Indonesia. And several dozen have been detained in various places trying to get to Syria.
Now, when the existing jihadist organisations oppose Islamic State, why are they opposing it?
For a number of reasons. Some of them have had a long-term affiliation to Al-Qaeda. They also reject the basis of the Islamic State. So they don't believe that it was established in the correct manner. And they also object.
So that's a theological argument, is it? Kind of.
Yes, it's a theological and a legal argument as to the correct way to form a caliphate. And they don't believe that there has been any seeking of consensus among Islamic leadership. They believe this is very much a maverick state that has been formed. Moreover, they strongly object to the way in which ISIS has attacked fellow Muslims, fellow Sunni Muslims. So the main Al-Qaeda-aligned group in Syria and Iraq is Jabhat al-Nusra, and ISIS has engaged in open battle with Jabhat al-Nusra and killed many of its fighters. So they regard this as an act of betrayal of the Islamic cause, and they don't accept that there is a case for the creation of a separate Islamic State.
There's a sense, though, from those groups, isn't there, that of Indonesian nationalism. I mean, Islamic State, despite the fact that it is spreading its influence around the world, is still very Middle Eastern focused. I mean, you know, the greater state across border, you know, the ancient state across the borders of Iraq and Syria.
Yes, the state of Sham. That is, in fact, one of the elements that attracts people, the notion of a transnational Islamic State, one that may have been in keeping with the design that the Prophet Muhammad had for his community. But in fact, one of the interesting dynamics here is the way in which precisely that pledge of loyalty to the Islamic State has helped to galvanise opposition to ISIS within Indonesia, and has certainly been one of the main sources of criticism of Abu Bakar Bashir and Aman Abdurrahman. The fact that Indonesians would, in effect, repudiate their own nationality, would repudiate their allegiance to the Republic of Indonesia and transfer that to a foreign state, moreover a foreign state that's legality is in question, that was provoked to quite an outpouring of criticism. And for mainstream Islamic groups and for the Indonesian government, this has been one of the reasons why we've seen a much stronger response to ISIS than we have to, for example, Jemaah Islamiyah 10 years ago when that organisation was really quite active.
So there was a report of a shootout last week in Sulawesi. Was that against IS or was that just against one of the older jihadist organisations?
If these kinds of activities are taking place on a regular basis, the police are rounding up sometimes with shootouts and the loss of life of suspected terrorists. These are happening almost weekly. In that particular incident in central Sulawesi, the people being targeted, according to the police, were members of this Eastern Indonesia Jihad Fighters Group, MIT, that's led by the most wanted terrorist in Indonesia at the moment, a man called Santoso. And
pro
that
or
group,
is he pro-ISIS?
So that group, MIT, is strongly pro-ISIS. And Santoso is one of the things that makes him dangerous is because he's trying to recruit for pro-ISIS activity, and he's certainly a propaganda advocate for al-Baghdadi as caliph.
What's your impression of the Indonesian government's response? I mean, are they all over this? Have they got good intelligence? Are they still getting assistance from the Australian Federal Police despite our difficult relationship at the moment?
Yes, sir. Certainly there is a lot of cooperation taking place between the Indonesian police and the Australian Federal Police. It's not quite as extensive and as warm as it was immediately after the Bali bombing, the first Bali bombing in 2002, but nonetheless it is significant. And certainly if we take a longer view of police relations between the two countries, it is still without precedent if we look before the 2002 period. There's certainly challenges, exchanges. Australia still does things such as provide a lot of the funding for the JCLEC Centre in Central Java, which provides training for police officers among other things, in counter-terrorism activities, and that's not just for Indonesian police officers, but for police investigators from around the region. So there's still a lot of those kinds of activities taking place on the Australian side. On the Indonesian side, yes, as I mentioned before, the government has been far more proactive on the ISIS issue than it has on any other previous terrorist threat, and a lot of that is to do precisely with the offence that Indonesians feel that some of their citizens have rejected their own country in favour of this Islamic State. And so the nationalist element of this is quite strong, and you'll more often see Indonesian officials objecting to the repudiation of Indonesian nationalism rather than to objecting to the human rights violations, for example, that have been carried out by ISIS. So there's a very strong nationalist tone here.
And the extent to which our response diplomatically to Indonesia has been adequate, you're a bit of a critic about over the last few years, with both governments, we've lost the plot a bit.
Well, I think one of the problems in the past, immediately after the 2002 Bali bombing, was that Australian leaders, as indeed did many Western leaders, they took a very simplistic approach to the nature of the problem and had a kind of simple set of rationalisations about who was doing this within the Islamic community and what was the essential nature of Islam. So a common phrase we heard was that Islam is a religion of peace and that people who undertake these extremist acts are not good Muslims, or perhaps not even Muslims at all, should not be considered Muslims at all. And that may play well in a Western domestic audience, but it doesn't play well in a community like Indonesia's Muslim community, which is largest in the world. And the first question people ask themselves is what gives the right to these Western leaders to make these judgments about who is a good or a bad Muslim. The acts that jihadists have undertaken may be heinous acts and they can be condemned, but the Western leaders who are non-Muslim should not be telling Muslims what a good Muslim is and what the essential nature of their faith is. And so it would be good if we could avoid that, if we could avoid Australian politicians going to Indonesia, for example, and visiting mainstream organisations and saying, you are the true Muslims, those other people are not, because people don't feel it's the right of Western leaders to make those kinds of statements.
Greg, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Norman.
Dr. Greg Feely, who's Associate Professor and Senior Fellow of Indonesian Politics at the Australian National University. And he's got a paper that Greg's written with his colleagues Evelyn Goh and Ristian Atriandi Suprianito, and it's titled A Strategy Towards Indonesia, and we'll have that on our website.